Calls number 12-30299. We'll hear first from the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. Jacob Garbin. Oh, Fatherslav Jacob Garbin, on behalf of Shedrick. I go by Jacob. May it please the Court. The two most significant issues that I believe prevented the awarding of benefits to Mr. Shedrick and the actions taken by the plan, which failed to meet the standards required, is one, the plan failed to provide a full and fair review of the evidence submitted to them, and additionally, they failed to follow the policy, the language of their own policy. There was a lack of transparency in the initial denial of Shedrick's claim. Initially, he was awarded 13 weeks worth of short-term disability benefits based on an objective MRI finding and the statements of his treating physician. In February of 2010, first there was a calculation of benefits that would be owed under long-term disability, which amounted to $22,736.96, meaning he would get 60% of that, or $13,642.176. After a review of the payments which would be made, there was an entry made in the administrative record by an administrator which said that based on a learned medical treatise that Mr. Shedrick's disability should only last for a certain short period of time. Following that discovery, a letter was sent, and it's in the record at 220 through 221. It's a March 4th, 2010 letter. It stated that Mr. Shedrick did not provide enough supporting evidence. Never was there any mention that a learned treatise or a medical treatise was used to support that initial denial. In addition to the administrator failing to inform the claimant of the use of the treatise, which is in violation of this court's prior ruling in LaFleur, the district court in part relied upon the fact that the treatise, in reaching their decision, said that Mr. Shedrick's disability should only have been for a certain short period of time. Now, in response to the request for more medical information, Mr. Shedrick provided medical information to the plan exactly as requested on forms required by the plan. It has Aetna letterhead. It has questions specifically to answer. The doctor answered the questions. They said, well, we need medical reports. Mr. Shedrick provided medical reports. Mr. Shedrick provided therapy notes. There was no medical basis at that point to deny his claim whatsoever. In spite of that, Mr. Shedrick provided all the authorizations that could possibly be needed for them to do an investigation if they so wanted to. I understand that there is language that administrators are not under a positive duty to do the research themselves. However, if there was anything more that they possibly needed, which there is actually no other medical records other than the ones he supplied, they could have done it themselves. In addition to failing to disclose the fact that they used a medical treatise to deny his benefits initially, Shedrick asked for an appeal through me, because at that point, every one of the documents in the record verified that Shedrick was completely disabled, unable to return to his own occupation, unable to perform the material duties of his own occupation, and records were supplied that showed his functional capacities as determined by Dr. Watermeyer. It was at that point that, without a doubt, Mr. Shedrick was unable to return to his own occupation. A vocational report was obtained by the administrator. The vocational report said did not certify that Mr. Shedrick could return to his own occupation, but rather said that there was a need to have Mr. Shedrick evaluated by a pain medication specialist. That was never done. The only time, and it's my belief that there is not even a scintilla of evidence to support factually the determination made by the administrator, I think that the only record, the only medical record that anywhere comes close to giving any doubt to the record was provided by Dr. Wahlquist. Dr. James Wahlquist, as cited previously, was determined by a court in Eastern District of Pennsylvania to be a non-credible witness. Now, the plan has objected to the use of this determination, but they held him out to be an independent peer reviewer. The Eastern District of Pennsylvania said he is not an independent peer reviewer. He is actually a staff physician. By reviewing the record, you'll see that Dr. Wahlquist actually makes entries into the administrative file on his own, just like any other administrator would. The other thing that I find either very coincidental was immediately before the review period ended, I mean the day before it ended, Dr. Wahlquist issued a report. The next day, the appeal was concluded. There was never an opportunity by Shedrick to see the report of Dr. Wahlquist, never an opportunity like in the Harper case in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania to present that record to Mr. Shedrick's physicians to check the veracity of the statements that were quoted by his own physicians. And I understand that the plan said, well, there has to end, the review process has to end at some point. But there's supposed to be a fair and meaningful dialogue between both the claimant and the plan in order to come to the resolution of whether this individual is owed benefits or not owed benefits.
Counsel, let me make sure I understand. From my reading of your brief and sources, you don't have anything specific to indicate Aetna's plan administrator's failure, but it's more of a conceptual thing that the procedures that were provided were not fair and reasonable to provide you an opportunity to respond to that last significant, probably, piece of evaluation. Is that fair?
I would say that that is part of the argument, Your Honor, is that there was never an opportunity to address anything that Dr. Wahlquist said. It was done on the eve of the final appeal denial.
Okay, but I guess I'm asking, you're right to respond the way you were, or reasonable, but I'm asking, there is nothing specific in the administrative process that is provided that they violated by not giving you an opportunity to respond to that last analysis.
Your Honor, I searched for a case. I looked through the CFRs. I found that there were no stated guidelines as far as we have to provide you with this consultative exam, and then you have so many days to respond to it. It's not in the CFRs. It's not in the statute. But I think that though a full and fair review would require an opportunity for the claimant, in this situation, Shedrick, to respond to it.
My understanding from the statements from in the process from the plan administrator ultimately and earlier is that the sense they were giving, their sense of this information that you're indicating, I don't know if you used this word, but were unrebutted, is that they were not substantial, that the doctors, that the physicians, had not explained sufficiently what their estimates of his disability were, explain what that was based on. What is wrong, particularly when we're looking at it in our differential viewpoint, what is wrong with that as a matter of procedure? You're disagreeing with it in this case, but isn't that a proper role for the plan review process? The employer doesn't have to rebut. It's up to the claimant to prove the case, and the administrator here determined that you had not.
I certainly appreciate that position, Your Honor. What I believe is this. They asked for a determination. They provided forms themselves, and they said, fill out these forms, complete these forms. The physician completed these forms. He said, this is my opinion.
Well, if you fill in all the blanks, that means that, I mean, I'm not trying to to ridicule the answer, because, I mean, it's a legitimate answer, but it doesn't seem to me that following the forms is much of a sufficiency in and of itself, explain the basis of your opinion. Well, what's in that form then becomes important and not the form itself.
I understand that completely. What I would say is that it is known that Mr. Shedrick had an MRI, objectively showed L5 nerve root impingement. He had a herniation. The physician was treating him conservatively, providing with narcotic medication. It seemed pretty clear, and even their own experts said, well, I don't know that this man could go back to his own occupation. I mean, those weren't the exact words, of course, of Mr. Scocopasso, but he certainly didn't certify this man's definitely ready to go back to his own occupation. And there has to be something concrete. There can't be just an abstract concept of, well, we want more, we want more. I certainly deal with that enough with my 5-year-old. The question of why, but at some point there has to be a pointed question issued either through their consultative examiner or through their request to the claimant that says, these are the specific things that we're looking for. And even Dr. Walquist, at his best, he's obviously an experienced reviewer. He's obviously done this previously, consultative examinations. He was not able to say that Mr. Shedrick performed the material duties of his occupation. Material duties is defined in the plan. It says duties that are normally required for the performance of your own occupation and cannot be reasonably omitted or modified. However, to be at work in excess of 40 hours per week is not a material duty, necessarily meaning that a 40-hour week is necessary by exclusion. Dr. Walquist couldn't say that.
Was the tested point in the record what level of physical activity his job required? Or is that agreed to by both sides?
I recognize that this court, and I think it's pretty uniform definition, that it's the Dictionary of Occupational Titles on a national standard. You were to look at that. I would say particularly, I don't recall, and I thought of that this morning, I don't recall ever seeing the actual Dictionary of Occupational Titles printout in the file for Mr. Shedrick. There was definitely his own occupation, what he was performing as Director of Engineering in the record, and the duties, I think, would be more than just a pure supervisorial position. He was in charge of fire watch, essentially. If anything occurred, any sort of emergency situation, then Mr. Shedrick was expected to be alert, on duty, ready to go. He was responsible for an entire hotel.
Well, let me ask, when did Aetna reclassify his job difficulty? Where in that, was that done before this injury? My understanding is he was initially classified as medium duty job and then was reclassified. Is that something you're familiar with, and when did that occur in relation to what we're talking about?
I am familiar with that, Your Honor. What happened was, due to self-reporting, Mr. Shedrick was asked, what are your job positions? He provided, I believe at that point, he had provided his job duties. And initially, based on the claimant's self-report, they said, this is a medium-duty job. They then said, well, they being the administration then retained a vocational expert who classified it as a light-duty job. And I see that I'm getting short on time. I would also like to point out that much has been made by the plan that they're in a fiduciary role to the plan itself, but I would like to also accentuate that there is a fiduciary duty not just to the plan, but also to Mr. Shedrick, that they were both the underwriter of the plan, and though the sliding scale scrutiny has been done away with, that it's another factor that Aetna was also protecting their policy, their plan, and Mr. Shedrick paid for these premiums for this policy, and he was owed the same fiduciary duty by the plan as they owed to the plan itself.
Is there much to the argument anymore after Met, Life, Glenn, whatever the name it was, to this conflict of interest point? Isn't it about gone from the case law?
Fair enough, and that is, the term used is any of, is an additional factor. That's the exact language used.
The period you put at the end after making the decision, perhaps.
That's perhaps true.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. May I please the court? Bob McCullough representing Aetna and Marriott. To start out with, I think it's undisputed that in these ERISA cases where you're dealing with a benefit issue, that the burden is on the person who's the claimant to present evidence to the administrator showing that, in fact, there is a disability. And this is what the plan says here. And the cases uniformly say that that's true. And it's not just to present evidence. They have to present objective medical evidence showing that the person can't do the job. And, you know, all Aetna does, you know, with the disability plan is these people sit up there every day and they review claims. I mean, this is what they do. And so what they're looking for is objective evidence. And, of course, there's plenty of ways a doctor can measure whether or not people can do certain physical tasks or whether or not they have cognitive disabilities that affect their ability to do the job. But initially, the claimant himself has to do this. Now, and you can look at this record, and I'm sure you have, they never presented any objective medical evidence to this effect.
The MRI is pretty objective, and then there are two physicians. I didn't even hear the appellant making the argument. I haven't understood this to be a case where there wasn't evidence of a serious injury and disability at the outset. Their complaint mostly is, as he described it, one of transparency, that the review process didn't disclose to them the use of the treatise. The review process didn't disclose to them until at the last second it was Dr. Wahlquist. So their argument is much more, there's no meaningful review because the things that become determinative for Aetna are not things that they've been told.
Well, to start with, insofar as the determination, what you have to focus on is the determination on the appeal. There's lots of things that happened. Obviously, this went on for a long time, back and forth. When you read the record, you'll see that Aetna repeatedly, there's a number of letters in there where they sent letters to Mr. Shedrick's lawyer saying, your claim's been denied, this is what we need, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And what the claimant would come back with is, you know, a lot of times it was the same thing that had been presented before, but there was never anything that was would be considered objective medical evidence that he couldn't do the job. Did he have this back condition? Yes, that's not disputed. The question is whether that back condition or the medication,
I thought the record also showed that your own client said, we can't determine that he can do the job unless a pain management person is consulted because his very real back injury requires pain medication. Isn't that the case?
There's a report by, I think it's I'm not pronouncing it right, but it's it was early on in the claims procedure where the analyst talked to Mr. Shedrick, you know, and asked him some questions, and primarily in the report was setting forth what Mr. Shedrick was telling him, you know, about how he felt and what his condition was. But then, you know, and of course that's considered as they go along. But then they were asking, we need from you objective medical evidence, you know, to this effect. And, you know, at the last phase, which is the appeal phase, where Carol Roy, who's an analyst and this is what she does, is looks at appeals, she asked Mr. Shedrick's lawyer, said, well, have you presented everything? You know, we don't want to decide this appeal until we've got everything you're going to present. And the lawyer said, no, this is all I'm going to present. So at that point, and this makes obviously sense, at that point, then they go to their outside consultant, Dr. Wahlquist, and say, well, look at this, and let us know what you think about whether or not this record shows that the person couldn't do his job.
What do you mean by outside? First, is that procedurally required in some way that it's an outside expert? And then secondly, is that what Dr. Walquist was?
Well, it's not procedurally required that he's an outside expert.
It's not part of the
only
plan.
It's not part of the plan, and it's not part of the law, you know, all the, and it's not even necessarily required. It's helpful and obviously legitimate and makes huge sense for the analyst making the decision on appeal to get this additional input. You know, and Dr. Walquist, you know, he didn't just, besides looking at the records, he called the doctors that were treating Mr. Shedrick, you know, and Dr. Wattemeyer, which was the key doctor, said, well, yeah, I think he can do a sedentary job, you know, which you could equate to a light-duty job. And Dr. Walquist also said on this medication thing, and I don't know whether Dr. Wattemeyer said this, but it is in Dr. Walquist's report, that there was absolutely no medical testing to indicate whether or not the medication had a negative cognitive impact on Mr. Shedrick. So, you know, and then an appeal analyst looks at this, looks at the record, and made a decision that there was not sufficient objective medical evidence that he couldn't do his job, and perfectly proper and on this record was the correct decision. One thing I do want to correct, because I stated it wrong in the brief, and they pointed it out, and properly so, that was the DOL regulation that says that if there's a medical judgment being made during the appeals process of a disability plan, that then you need to go to a qualified medical expert. And he's right in the sense, I just looked at it, and it was under benefit, it was under insurance plans, but the regulations later on say it does apply to a disability plan. But the point I would make is that wasn't true here. There was no evidence, no objective medical evidence in the record that would require the plan to go seek a qualified medical expert. But notwithstanding that, I don't think anybody can say that Dr. Walquist is not a qualified medical expert. I mean, he's an orthopedic surgeon. And clearly, he's qualified to talk about whether or not, based on the record.
I think there are two points they make to call into question that are, one, his status connected to Aetna, and two, the criticism he received in the case they're referring to out of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, to tell you the truth, I don't know whether he is a staff physician, but I don't think the record says whether he is or not. So I don't know that. I mean, I don't think the court can make a decision, you know, one way or another. I frankly don't think it would matter whether he's a staff physician or not. You know, the only question is, you know, is there some reason to think he's biased, that he's not doing his job properly? And there certainly is no evidence to that effect. And if that's their argument.
Go to the CFR regulation that requires that he be experienced in training. Does case law interpreting that call into question those qualifications for either of those two reasons? One, a conflict of interest, or two, other courts having stated that you didn't meet that level of experience and reliability.
I'm sorry, Judge. I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, you agree that the regs require that this physician that's consulted have the experience and qualifications that he's asserting. And there are two points that they're making. Well, they're making three. They're saying in terms of full, fair review, they never knew his identity, and therefore they had no chance to respond in the dialogue.
Right.
And had they had the chance, I guess what they're saying is, one, they would highlight that he's in a conflict of interest position. You say the record doesn't bear that out to be true. And the other point I believe they've made repeatedly in briefs and in oral argument is that a different court in Pennsylvania, focusing just on this physician, concluded that his experience and his training wasn't adequate. Are you familiar with that case?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, obviously it's been cited, and I read it, yeah.
Okay.
Well.
Not relevant or not true?
Well, both.
Okay.
You know, it really isn't admissible evidence. You know, I mean, you can't, you can't go to some other decision involving different facts. You know, Judge Applick looked at it and said, hey, this, I can't say based on this, you know, that Dr. Walkus is biased or right. or not capable or anything else. So, no, you can't do that. You know, and at this point, we didn't get a chance, you know, from plaintiff's point, we didn't get a chance to know who he was and respond to that before the decision because it was done at the last step. Well, it makes sense from an administrative standpoint to do it at the last step. And I don't think you're going to find any case that says that, you know, any time that the administrator, as the last step, goes to a doctor, that they've got to call up the plaintiff and say, hey, we're going to use this doctor, and we'll give you a report, you know, and then you can put in rebuttal evidence. You know, I mean,
can I so. Just one last question on him?
Sure.
Would you agree that it would be a different story under our case law, specifically the LaFleur case, if that last step, Dr. Walquist, had stepped in and changed a prior assessment made by Aetna? In other words, instead of being a constant determination that he just ratifies, the determination from within had always been the opposite, and then he makes a conclusion. Would there be any right of rebuttal at that point under our case law?
I think you'd have to look at the specific record in a specific case. Obviously, that's not true here. I guess I wouldn't say never, ever. Is it possible that if you had that total change, that some kind of a fairness standard might say, hey, you got to give the other side an opportunity to look at that? But certainly not in almost any, but maybe some really egregious case could that be true.
It is accurate to view this record, though, that even though the claimant, after this final decision was announced, did present some objections, the response from the administrator was not even to consider those objections and said that administrative process is over, you have the right to go to court. Is
yeah, that, and I think that...
Because there were objections or response filed after Dr. Walquist's views were announced, was there not?
Well, I don't recall anything that was actually directed at Dr. Walquist or his opinion.
Well, at least chronologically it occurred after that decision, yeah. And I think the administrator basically rejected it out of hand.
And I guess the question legally would be, after the administrative process is done, and the record is closed, which is true here, does the administrative process have to be reopened any time a claimant, after it's been closed, presents something additional? And I would say no, there is no such requirement. In fact, here, Carol Roy considered the additional information, and as I recall, it was some information about the prescriptions, nothing about how they cognitively affect Mr. Shedrick, and I can't remember what the other point was, but she did consider him, and in her mind, it didn't change anything, and frankly, I don't think it would change anything.
You can give some of that back if you think you've covered it.
I think I've covered it. Thank you.
All right, counsel. Thank you.
Your Honors, I would disagree with two points made by the plan just in the prior argument. One, there was objective medical evidence. Not only was there an MRI, but also included in our excerpts at SE14, Dr. Watermeyer notes that there were muscle spasms in the back. That is an objective finding.
But I think he's saying it's not so much the medical injury, it's that you didn't make objective showings of inability to do the level of work, light work. Right? That's the connection. I think I understood him to be clarifying. He wasn't denying the MRI or the original medical testimony.
I would say that the objective medical findings based extrapolating the objective findings by the physician to the job duties, as explained to Watermeyer, by Shedrick, Dr. Watermeyer used those objective findings of spasm, MRI, and said this was not, he could not return back to his own occupation. And in the first 24 months of the policy, that would be the standard we're looking at. If he can return to his own occupation, not any reasonable occupation with accommodation. The other point that I would also disagree with is their duty to look into the matter regarding pain medication. As recently as when he saw Dr. Vroman, and we included that in our excerpts, that's SE2, pain medication, Dr. Vroman in the beginning said that this is impairing his cognitive function. Continuously throughout the entire initial 24-month period, Mr. Shedrick continued to receive pain medication, powerful narcotic medications such as Vicodin, Zodol. The vocational expert that they retained was completely aware of it, and that's why he said, this is why we need to talk to a pain medication specialist. This is the case is somewhat similar to Robinson versus Aetna, same administrator, wherein the administrator did not do a proper vocational review, did not include the vocational review into the record, and that is one thing that occurred in this situation.
I thought the Robinson case, like LaFleur, both involved the administrator changing opinions.
In a way, this is also a change of opinion. They had initially approved him for benefits, and then they said, wait, stop, let's hit the brakes. We're going to say it's not enough information. We need more information.
The change from the temporary benefits initially? Is that the change you're talking about?
Yes. The short-term disability benefits are owed for the first 6 months under the policy. It's on a week-to-week basis. At that point, they were paying him $1,626, I believe, per week. Then in February, the policy completely changed. They reversed themselves. And I do understand there is case law that says, well, just because they reverse their position doesn't necessarily mean that they did something incorrect in reviewing the matter.
It was identified as a temporary condition. So I don't know if that's a change in position. At some stage, a temporary matter ends. And so did Aetna really change, or did they just say the conditions of our initial determination have now been met?
Well, I think that it's this, Your Honor. He was still under the short-term disability policy when they first terminated his benefits, before the long-term disability was to commence. And so they initially said, all the evidence you have to this point is good enough, and then they said, now it's not. Here, we decided that it's not good enough, even though you provided objective evidence. And I think the linchpin on that is going to be the treatise on which was never provided in the record, which is required. The case slips in my mind right the second, but it is cited in my brief.
If your case reduces to sort of lack of transparency, in spite of how long this went on, it becomes important that you have a case that says it's not a fair and meaningful dialogue if you don't rebut your own internal request for pain, if you don't allow us to rebut Dr. Wahlquist, or if you don't disclose everything that went into your decision-making. Do you have any case, and it may be the one you're saying you've forgotten, that stands for any of those propositions?
It is cited in my brief. Okay. I just forgot the name of the case at this particular moment, unfortunately.
If it's in there.
That happens, I'm sure. But they said, yes, look, you have to tell the claimants, you have to let them know in the record, not just the claimant, the court that's going to review this. You're looking to see if they had substantial evidence. And, you know, it's our position that they didn't provide that information.
All right, counsel. Thank you. Thank you both. This concludes.